In the way this program has been sort of conceptualized, we wanted to have the first two speakers speak from the point of view of a more conceptual approach. And this second half of the program will be more focused on case studies. And this is outside, and it has the biographies of everybody. But it's a real special pleasure to introduce André Odenthal. So when we were researching the Art Against Apartheid collection, a friend who's a film producer in Cape Town helped me, like from one person to the next. It was really strange how I ended up at a meeting to meet André at the headquarters of the Cricket Association, and his office overlooks a cricket field, and there's actually a photo to prove it. I only had my BlackBerry to record our conversation, and it was an interview with him and a curator, Gordon Metz. So, and over the years, André has been extremely helpful and generous with us. He is a historian. He is not an art historian. And he's actually a man who's worn many hats. He's built museums. He runs an archive, or he's on the board of an archive of anti-apartheid struggle. And he's a historian. He's known for his books on cricket in South Africa. But he's writing now books about the history of the Constitution and other serious subjects. André, thank you for being here and welcome.
Thanks very much, Rasha. It's been wonderful to be in Berlin for the first time. And having traveled to 50 countries in the world, I must add, but just wonderful to meet you and Christine after those years of talking to each other. And also just to say thanks very much to Anka. Junior helped me very much. Paz and Anselm, listening to you and your fellow curators and intellectuals has been absolutely wonderful. The exhibitions, the talks, the music has been really good, and a couple of rides next to the river by bike has also been a good way of getting to know Berlin. So I have had a very strange career, as Rasha said. Not only did I have this beautiful office overlooking the main cricket field in South Africa with under Table Mountain, but I also for 7 years lived on Robben Island and worked there and had a view of the city across the bay. And so I started at UWC with Siraj, went to Robben Island Museum, and then went into cricket administration and running this professional team in South Africa, one of the six. But in the last 5 years, having gone all those directions, I've been writing full-time as an independent scholar. And Rasha and Christine have pulled me out here to come and talk about something that happened 30 years ago. And 1 January 1997 was a very profound moment in my life, because on that day, I got the keys of Robben Island Maximum Security Prison in my hand as the director, and handed them over to an ex-prisoner called Lizo Bright Ngungwana, who was a freedom fighter who unfortunately died in an accident soon afterwards. And our job was to symbolically throw open the prison doors after 3 centuries of banishment, othering people, marginalizing people, and pain in a very deep way. And that is a picture of the Robben Island earliest prisoners arriving on Robben Island in 1960. The Sharpeville massacre happened in March 61, And within a year, in April, March 60, and in April 1961, Robben Island Maximum Security Prison was opened. And there we were on this day, 1st of January 97, opening up symbolically that space. Lizo was one of those who'd entered chained, and he was now helping to reimagine and reinvent the island with the keys in his hands. And having listened to many stories by ex-Robben Islanders in that prison, one of the things that they really missed was children's voices. The absence of children's voices was a cause of like deep pain for many of them. They lamented the profound deprivation they had faced of not being allowed to hear, talk to or touch children, even their own, for 10, 16, 20, and in one case, 23 years, not being able to touch or speak to a child, was just one aspect of that incredible experience that Robben Island was for people. Choosing a child for us also reflected the humane future for South Africa that the founders of democracy envisaged. So there was a turn of the key, and prison doors always make a very clanging, loud noise, buzzing voices, and small barefoot feet pattered into the passages, a ballet of freedom. This was a throat-constricting moment of immense meaning for all of those who were present. So after 300 years, the island entered a new phase of history, and democratic South Africa was taking one small step forward after the institutionalized violence of colonialism and apartheid. And I specifically say that institutionalized violence, because whether we're doing art or interpreting history and we don't acknowledge that, something fundamental from an African perspective will be missing. So, Rasha, thanks for the welcome. Flinging open those prison doors on the island was one of the most special experiences of your life, but it's also a privilege for me to be here tonight, as I've said, in this beautiful house of culture sitting in the heart of a great city, and to participate in our session in the respectful commemoration of our oppressed people in different parts of the world fought against oppression in creative and imaginative ways. And I think creativity and imagination and finding the human and the social within, or trying to maintain it, lies at the heart of all struggles. And yours is those pictures of the linkages on the wall is an incredible picture of how artists in one area of life linked up with each other in a way that's not known. Berlin is, of course, where Africa was carved up in 1884 by people poring over a map and drawing lines across it to decide what would be theirs. It was not a quick event like I thought it was. Siraj told me it took several weeks of horse trading and bargaining before each person took away their piece of Africa. And it was probably people sitting not far from us where we are tonight. But it's not necessary to explain to this audience what a violent and exclusionary process European colonialism has been. We've seen the exhibitions launched and listened to the talks these past 2 days to know that. One of the strands of colonialism that has interested me is how the colonial subject was removed from history. To the extent that the Oxford historian A.J.P. Taylor could note as late as the 1950s that Africans were a mere footnote to history. They'd made no real contribution to human progress worth noting. And the great African novelist Chinua Achebe noted that in the colonial situation, presence was the critical question, the crucial word. Its denial was the keynote of colonialist ideology. Just that thing called presence, even though you're in a space with other people and you are not seen in that space. Apartheid, of course, was a toxic outflow of colonialism. It was the unloved late 20th century sort of progeny of colonialism. And our South African history school's textbooks underline those lessons that we inherited from our European background, ways of behavior and the mentalities in the colonial spaces. The apartheid textbooks only had six black people that were mentioned in them. Gandhi was one of them, and three or four of the others were collaborators with the government at more or less that time. So there was no Mandela or Biko or Sobukwe, there was no Sharpeville, no blood was shed on these pages, no Soweto uprising, and the Bulhoek massacre in 1922 were not in these pages. Black people appear only as problems, and this was history books taught to for decades to generations of school children, went to 15 editions, one of them. And one historian called this history as negation. His name is Colin Bundy, who was our colleague at UWC, and he said, these works are to the discipline what the black hole is to matter, a kind of anti-knowledge. And so most of us working as historians in South Africa, in my case for 40 years, has been to try and rebut these narratives. And for me, establishing Africans as agents in history is absolutely crucial as part of this political struggle that has happened. And that is to use Christine and Rasha's book title, it's not actually the exhibition's title and our event today, not Past Disquiet, but Decentering the Narrative. So that really, as a historian in South Africa today, is almost and has been for a time as a priority. And with the aim of not only debunking an orthodoxy in terms of details, retelling the story in a slightly different way, but to create a new whole paradigm of understanding and explaining our past. As a white South African, Nadine Gordimer spoke about the necessary destabilization of the self to move from the mentality of whiteness into humanity. And that is so true of us as white South Africans. You have to change the entire paradigm. And I think the same applies really to Europe, because we have these 500 years of thought and classical buildings and stuff that trap us all in that same mentality of whiteness when we look at the world today, Donald Trump, and some of these tendencies that we see. But for me in South Africa, it was this destabilization of the self that was very important. And we have a situation again now where after 1994 and democracy, after 25 years further struggling, we've got to come up with new processes of remaking, as my colleague said last night. Because this colonial inheritance of denial and exclusion is so powerful that even you write your histories, you bring out your little past disquiets, it still sits there like a massive, immovable present that forces people into a permanent state of invisibility. Ben Okri wrote a novel about the African who is invisible, and so was his mother invisible. But they had lived through countless centuries of lived experience and told their tales over time, but it was in the history books that he saw he didn't exist. And his search was to find the people who were visible. Just the way in which Africans are totally taken out of global narratives in every respect. And my two areas of work are the making of the South African Constitution, the first one in 1910, the fourth one in 1994. And even in the 1994 narrative, where it's the liberation struggle that reaches the pinnacle of success and becomes the new power and national sovereignty is attained. When you read the narratives of that story today, it is British ambassadors who spoke to that one, it is talks that happened there, and the people who brought about the change through generations of imagination and struggle and resilience and just living in everyday, trusting the imaginations that come from their communities and their lived experience, do not feature in these books. So in 2019, I have to write a book on the making of democratic South Africa that actually tells you what black people did to bring about change in South Africa. It's amazing to me how profound those exclusions are from these two works. The other one is a history of cricket. So I'm writing a post-colonial history of a colonial game going back to 1795 when the first British warships sailed into Table Bay. And with the cannons and the guns and the bayonets were also cricket bats and cricket balls. And that's how cricket came to Africa. But in the first four volumes of the history of South African cricket, from the 1800s to 1960, there is one scorecard. And I know people here know nothing about cricket, probably. Some know a bit about rugby after today. But one scorecard with 18 names in a 150-year period. I've written a book called Cricket and Conquest with some collaborators, which locates, which first of all takes away the romance of sport. Cricket as fair play. Cricket came out of the army as it rolled across South Africa until it conquered the whole 1 million square miles of the country. And cricket was a military game for the first 40 years, like the Americans taking baseball to Iraq, and eventually the Iraqis will play baseball in 2045 or something. That's how cricket came to South Africa. And into that was built these mentalities. And even today, people say, take politics out of sport. Even the formerly oppressed will say that, not knowing how deeply ingrained and shaped sport and its discourses are by this incredible history, this systemic violence. And so that's where I come from in terms of when I approach these subjects, just the incredible, as a white South African, after 30 years, still just being almost disbelieving about this, the level of exclusion that happens in many different levels. Like women in society, I'm sure it's the same kind of thing. And so there I was writing my history of the early 19th century, and then came archives and museums. I was lucky to find a small space in an amazing struggle during a tumultuous decade in the 80s, and thereafter to become director of the Mayibuye Center for History and Culture in South Africa, and of course the Robben Island Museum. It was a specific moment in our history in South Africa which was so special to live through. Like the fall of the wall 30 years ago, I'm sure for people living here, it was a time when history and culture and the struggle over the narrative and the image was a life-defining journey, and all your energy seemed to flow together as an intellectual and an activist, helping in little ways to vision and build a new future, and in the process being enriched by the courage, the resilience, the generosity, and the sense of solidarity of so many people. So I can imagine these French artists sitting in Paris and getting donations, battling, making contact with Beirut, and out of this comes these rich human interactions and imaginations that get created in that process of solidarity. Okay, so you can see I can go on a bit about these things. Let's see where I am. So this was Robben Island for three centuries. It was actually, it's just a smudge in Table Bay. It was censored. You could not see Robben Island on a tourist map or even a map of Cape Town before 1994. There was always a Caltex petrol advert or something in the bay where the island was, because that was the place where South Africans didn't want to see. That's where the place where the othered people were deposited for three centuries. So there we were on this amazing day. And it was a very simple opening of the island. We had to open the museum within 3 months. The Holocaust Museum in Washington took 6 years to develop, and at that time, $200 million. The African American Museum is closer to $1 billion, and they took 11 years. We took 3 months to open up Robben Island as a national museum. That, again, is the kind of way South Africa, you know, there were so many other things that had to be done after that apartheid era. And it was a spring clean of society from beginning to end. And we kept saying, Robben Island is closing, is going to be opened up because the prisoners are, the prison people are leaving on the 1st of January. And only on the 6th of September did the cabinet decide, okay, Robben Island will become a national museum. So we had to jump in there and open it. And the way we did it was to run the old prison boats and to ask ex-prisoners to take a limited number of people around the island every day on very strictly controlled personal tours. And that was the only way we were able to open as a museum. And by that time, it was 2 years after democracy, everyone wanted to see where Mandela's cell was. That again brought its own problems, but that the whole world, as you'll see now, wanted to see that. I'll quickly go there. So that's the island, quite spectacular, lying in the bay with that magnificent mountain in the background. And as I say, until 1994, that we had to open up the island in many different ways, including marketing it now. And it then became one of the big six, using this African thing of the big five animals or whatever, if you came down to the Cape. So many people went from there. We also then set up, you can see on the next one, that was our newspaper that we set up, a building that we built in the waterfront to have a footprint or a signature of Robben Island on the mainland. And there was our staff waiting for Mandela to land by helicopter, which were totally different in demographic looks to anything that had existed before in South African museums. Because in 1990, 97% of all national monuments in South Africa represented the colonial or apartheid experience. There was one black education officer in all the museums of Cape Town, not one manager, never mind a director, and no people working besides cleaners and drivers, effectively. Dumisani Sibai was about the only one, and then the Abramses came and so on. And of course, the whole world wanted to go there. And I had to show, of course, Arafat, given that we're talking Beirut, and he actually opened the exhibition. I was there that day, of course, which was quite special. If I do write a book one day about these things, it'll be on the edges of history. You can see me standing there in the back next to his head. And then and then there's Castro, who was the most popular visitor ever to Robben Island. And he said to me, how many prisoners have you got, as he came off the boat? And I said, only one, Comrade President, you. And it was just, he was by far the most popular visitor for South Africans for specific reasons, because the Cubans had supported South Africa in Angola and elsewhere. Kofi Annan, it just became a literal thoroughfare of international visitors, which is one of the reasons why Robben Island had to be set up so quickly. And that was Bill Clinton and an amazing visit by Stevie Wonder, who, though blind, totally felt the space. He just like had this incredible feeling of being in the space and spoke about it. Absolutely amazing. And I mean, those are just some presidents. There were about 20 or 25 in my time, and some celebrities, of which the entire Hollywood seemed to come. but also Nobel Prize winners like Dorfman and Wallace Soyinka, who suggested we start an African Writers' Parliament on Robben Island, which I love the idea of, but unfortunately my council thought, no, you've got to look after other things first. And that's a special time. Only about 15 people ever had their photos taken with Mandela in the cell. And the person who was in that photo with us, but I've photoshopped him like Trotsky was photoshopped. Out of that was Bill Cosby, because it was a special event that people paid 200,000 rand a photo for to pose, and I came in at the end. The president said we could have one there with Jacques Gerwel, who is our rector at UWC, who became the director general in the president's office. But that picture there at the bottom is very special as well. And Siraj is here, I'll often refer to him because we were colleagues, was responsible for, with us, to set up the Robben Island Museum training program to start bringing in black people who'd never been, you know, museums were like strange places to black people in South Africa. And that was the first thing we tried to do, was start this Robben Island Museum training project, which they carried on after the museum, shamefully at some stage, gave up on it. And they've trained 250 African museum curators. And the process of learning, Robben Island was called the University of the Struggle, because 3,500 people were there, and learning became a priority. You taught someone who was illiterate to read, to write their own letters home. Someone you finished your schooling. Other people did 3 degrees. And there were very sophisticated intellectuals there, like Neville Alexander, who taught German to people while they were digging in the quarries and so on. So this notion of Robben Island as a university was very crucial. And I must try to stick to my script here, but I'll come to that more. It was also, those are some of the groups who came to visit, sort of role-playing and so on. And the bottom up, I especially put in because it was traditional healers who came to Robben Island to appease the ancestors. They say this place has got so much pain, there's so much that's happened here, we need to make a sacrifice to the ancestors. So I'm trying to show you what a museum director's job was like on Robben Island, from attending sacrificial events to presidents to all sorts of things, and getting death threats as well. So one day in the post, a letter came with a photograph that was in the newspaper with a bullet hole in my forehead. And I mean, it's just, you know, it was an experience that was beyond kind of, it was so powerful, just the experience of being in that space. And people in meetings would just burst out crying after 2 months of being in the space and so on. Incredibly powerful, and we tried to build on that kind of meaning. And it was obviously something very profound for us. I'm just going to have to go back a little because I want to show where the Robben Island Museum started from. And it was basically on a university that was redefining the role of intellectuals, and again, in society. And again, that has a meaning for you guys, yeah, in an institution in Europe. I know you are very settled societies. We were upside down and going through things, so there was a space to challenge and to challenge and to create new things. And I think it's very good that, you know, you're having these kind of discussions about decentering the canon and talking about the geopolitics of global art and so on. And What made Robben Island actually happen was a preliminary project that came out of this redefining itself of this university at the height of the insurrectionary period and when apartheid was at its most oppressive. And University of Western Cape was started for coloureds only, so there were no Africans or no whites at this university. It was a very bizarre when I walked in there on my first day to find like this is like Havana, Cuba. It's like not South Africa. But it was the most amazing place to be because after student struggles in the 70s and 80s, it started to redefine its mission, calling into question the whole system of knowledge production and history in South Africa. So UWC consciously shed its apartheid heritage, said we were created as an apartheid institution, we were called a bush college because we're not a real university, and we're going to become, our goal is to become the intellectual home of the democratic left in South Africa. So its mission then became to serve what was called the third world communities, and to develop, and this was important for us in the struggle, I don't know how it plays out in Nicaragua and other places, but to develop an open and critical alignment with the political movements and organizations committed to the struggle for liberation. So the rector explained that the ideological orientation of a university, the social philosophy which it privileges, is often accepted quite unproblematically as if it was natural. And within South Africa, he said the racialized, privileged white universities were either Afrikaner nationalist or liberal capitalist, which is a bit of a contradiction in terms in South Africa in the 1980s because it was very rooted within the ruling class kind of power block. So UWC would now look to create a different path. And so that was times of states and emergency, 15,000 attentions, when people on campus said, why don't we start a kind of Holocaust museum idea for apartheid? Aim to be a living historical and cultural center, collect materials because the apartheid signs are starting to come down. Tremendous censorship where you could get 4 years in jail for having Mandela's name scratched on a coffee cup. And to actually walk around with papers could be a death sentence or a jail sentence, depending on the kind of security police who found you with banned material. So universities still created spaces, for instance, to show in a history class a banned video on the ANC when you weren't allowed to quote the ANC anywhere in the newspapers in South Africa. But what was special for me as a historian coming out of the old school was that the programs and activities cut across traditional boundaries between town and gown. You know, the old Cambridge where I studied versus the town with the monastic kind of tradition. Between disciplines and very importantly in the late 80s, between different media. Because I was working with film people, art people, photography, publishing, and creative community outreach, and that just opened up my eyes as a historian. And at a very important stage, I was lucky that happened because it was the beginning, of course, of the technological revolution where everything, the old breakdown of disciplinary boundaries and so on was happening. So this was barefoot collecting, like Rasha speaks about. The only material she could find was for old people who'd been involved in these things. And it was also, the timing was perfect for us in South Africa. Because in 1987, 88, 89, we didn't know that there would be unbanning of organizations by 1990 and democracy by 1994. So the timing of this project was perfect. It became almost a kind of national pilot project for what needed to be done, and people were wanting, established museums and others were hungry for this and brought papers in plastic bags that they'd hidden. One newspaper that was banned, as the police came in to stop the printing presses of the World newspaper in October 1977, he took the front page off the printing press. He did for 16 years and brought it to us when it came and said, this I want here. And there were lots of examples like that. So the power of the archive, if you create life, intellectual and otherwise, in it. So I would say the center became an institutional base at that stage for what could be called the decolonization project. Today, decolonization is a big word, because since 2015, the youth revolution or youth rebellion has saying nothing has changed since democracy and decolonization hasn't happened. We've got to break down. Fundamental power shifts must happen here in South Africa, because people are still excluded and marginalized. And this was at a time when universities, museums, cultural institutions, scholarships, newspapers, every kind of institution was totally complacent in its, especially anti-apartheid people, even from a kind of liberal perspective that said we are against apartheid, but didn't problematize their own position within the system as well. And so we got, I'll just go through it very quickly. Like Rasha, the international, and Christine, the international aspect was crucial in the formation of Mayibuye Center. We got huge amounts of material from local people, but the big thing that made it possible to become a proper museum was the papers of the International Defense and Aid Fund in London, which was the nerve center of the international anti-apartheid movement. So they had contacts all over the world, including with all the kind of people that you mentioned, and we ended up with that entire collection there. So material that had been banned in South Africa for 20 years and which was being collected outside came and landed on our doorstep, which was quite amazing. And you can see the Mayibuye Center logo. No, you can't. So that, to me, symbolized almost. It wasn't struggle with a big S and a big P in a narrow sense. It was the celebration of life of people who refused to accept that system and in a very restricted environment still try to celebrate that. That is Yuma Sakela getting his first trumpet from Archbishop Huddleston, and it came from Satchmo himself. Again, the global linkages that are always there when there's progress, when there's human progress and solidarity and empathy. It's an amazing photograph, 1950s, and he was by then famous as a famous trumpeter. Mayibuye Center, look at that kind of, there's something very nice about that logo. I love the logo. You must look at that logo and feel what that project's about. And the same we had at Robben Island. We had a beautiful logo. But look at, this is Abdullah Ibrahim, the famous jazz pianist, playing at a concert, playing at Ruth First's funeral in Maputo in 62. She was assassinated by a bomb, parcel bomb that blew her head off, and there the musicians were there. And it was in that music, around that pain, around those mass funerals. There was never a funeral or a sad moment that music and culture wasn't present there in the struggle. And that is why South African music and creativity is so fantastic, our creative people. So on the campus, we started a mural trail, bringing in people that had never been there before. And this is, the one on the right is by Malangatana, the Mozambican artist. And I mean, that is just so amazing to arrive in a project run by 4 permanent staff and 10 student assistants to get art like that. It just came. There was such a need for that kind of thing to be happening in South Africa. And that is one of 10,000 photos, or 3, 5 maybe. Maybe I mustn't exaggerate, that a friend and I found in London with a very old, frail person with a very bright mind who'd been keeping a suitcase full of her late husband's images from the 1940s under a bed in her flat. And she said, I've been trying to interest people in this, and it's this Leon Levson collection of African lives in the 40s, which he's written about as well. And there's the photographer being photographed, you know. In Johannesburg, urban life in the 40s, beautiful stuff. The dream all along at Maibuye was to go and to be that a national museum. And Robben Island, after democracy, became that place. And this photo on the left, sorry that it's such a small thing. We've got, I couldn't dig deep enough into my boxes of 30 years ago. But that is the Artists Against Apartheid exhibition. The ANC, when Ernest Pignon brought, offered it to South Africa, like the PLO one and the Chile one, they decided, the ANC, that it must come to us at Maibuye Centre rather than the National Gallery, which at that stage was still very untransformed, and that this exhibition needed to be given that kind of respect in a symbolic term. And it became, in 1996, the old apartheid photographs of the old presidents and prime ministers, all white, were brought down, and that exhibition was put into the space. And Robben Island, we got all these collections in many different ways. Every time the Robben Island prisoners came off the island, they were carrying all their worldly possessions in cardboard boxes. And eventually we saw that inevitably it was an apple box that the things were in. So we created the apple box archives that the Robben Island prisoners left behind. So that was the kind of informal collecting that just came into the thing. So I'm not going to go back into Robben Island because, what is the time? Can you tell? How many minutes? Okay. Because I can carry on with these things. But so Maibuye Centre became a kind of pilot project that delivered a lot of stuff and was also involved in trying to create new policy for a democratic South Africa. University of Western Cape as a whole was very prominent in that. So the new Constitution Committee came and sat there. There were a lot of transforming projects on the campus because it was now planning for a government to be in government rather than being in opposition only. And Ahmed Kathrada, who was with Nelson Mandela for 27 years, said, we will not forget the brutality of apartheid. We will not want Robben Island to be a monument to our hardship and suffering. We want it to be a monument reflecting the triumph of the human spirit against the forces of evil, freedom and dignity over repression and humiliation, wisdom and largeness of spirit against small minds and pettiness, courage and determination over human frailty and weakness, and triumph of non-racialism over bigotry and intolerance. So those are all very beautiful words, and that was the kind of vision that we came, that permeated in 1994 when the transition happened. And what we wanted to do on Robben Island was to maintain that activism, that intellectual, critical perspectives. And I think looking back at these core essences, as we call them, is quite amazing. If you look there, obviously this is an internationally symbolic site. What are we going to do with it? A heritage and conservation project for the new millennium, also very big in vision, but strives to maintain the unique symbolism, nurtures creativity and innovation, contributes to socio-economic development, the transformation of society and the enrichment of humanity. I mean, I love reading it now, that enrichment of humanity and nurturing creativity and innovation. And one of the five core principles was promoting the museum as a platform for critical debate and lifelong learning. So it wasn't just a political subservient, it's now our turn and rah, rah, rah. From our university base, we always had this idea of trying to inject a critical dimension to the whole project. And that's why listening here the last few days has also been very interesting for me. But obviously, so it was in the context of dramatic change that we really provided a radical template for museums at the time, I think. So it was a laboratory for transformation and new intellectual approaches as well. And one of them was the Artists in Residence program. So bring artists in there, let them try and interpret from their own perspective what it all means and what they see and the different levels of experience that Robben Island went through. And there were just amazing kind of outcomes of that. One day I was driving around the island just at sunset, and there was one of the artists in residence sitting on the far side of the island where the bad weather came from, because it rains in winter in Cape Town. It's very cold. Prisoners are to sleep on the floor. And the foghorn goes off, boo, through the mist. And he was just trying to get a feel for what it must have been like as a composer, what it must have been like for the prisoners. And when we opened the prison, opened the museum, he had composed music on it, which was played through dried bamboo from this island by an Indian classical musician. And that was the kind of triumph of the human spirit idea. And it came from a very specific example of a prisoner who constructed a saxophone from flotsam and jetsam, picking stuff up on the sea, a piece of wood here, a bit of that there, and he made a... 2 minutes? He made a saxophone that could play, and it could still play a few years later. So that idea of the triumph of the human spirit was something that South Africans were saying, from our experiences, we want to create something different here. And one of them was maintaining the social and human within you. So people rolled up socks and made little footballs to play silent games in their cells. They did ballroom dancing and produced dramas, and they brushed their hands like this rather than clap so that the warders wouldn't hear them. And the saxophone story I've said. That's a picture from the 80s of two African men dancing together in the prison, which I found quite amazing for that time, in a very homophobic country. And then we've come to democracy, and there's no more symbolic space. The president and half of the ANC's MPs, it was reported, were ex-Robben Islanders after 1994. But today we live in a very different world, and South Africa sometimes appears as a sad parody of the 1980s dreams and visions. I'm just going to end it off here. Yeah, democracy and the free society. Now let's go back to a photograph there. There's a Robben Islander poet on the Dennis Brutus, who was a poet as well. Democracy and the free society brought many magnificent benefits, but the country remains deeply fractured and gripped by systemic crisis. Great divide between rich and poor remains huge. Services everywhere are in parlous decline. Education, electricity, sewerage, water, transport, police, municipal government, trains, Siraj and I were saying today when we went on the U-Bahn. And the trauma is exacerbated by the fact that 25 years After 25 years in power, the liberation movement turned government is, by its own admission, full through from top to bottom with corruption, and there's been state looting and capture, state capture. And so really we have to, where does that leave us? We've got to again start the process of remaking, as my colleague said yesterday. We've got to understand the changing context and develop new languages and understandings for creating social justice, peace, and sustainability. We've had student movements in South Africa who've brought up the issue of intersectionality, how women in different ways are affected. It's not a binary between good and bad. It's not a choice between ever-expanding capitalism or dogmatic Marxism. We've got to deal with climate change and globalization and the fourth industrial revolution. And so it makes it a whole new debate. But the issues for us is to start rethinking the process of how we once again challenge a system that is in many ways not working in creative ways. And really to do so by engaging and reaching out as academics and artists in empathy and solidarity with our fellow human beings in a new age of othering, marginalization, and systemic violence that continues. I think I'll end there. I don't know where I am in my lecture, but thanks very much.